يا دمه يا دمه بالأفضل كفناه بالأحمر كفناه بالأبيض كفناه.
Dr. Dalia Wasfi talks about the human costs of the war and occupation of Iraq. American-born of an Iraqi father and Ashkenazi Jewish mother, she is a very personable speaker who engages her listeners with her American humor, even while talking about tragic events. And she shows photographs throughout her talk of ordinary Iraqi men, women, and children, including members of her own family, thus breaking through the stereotypes about Iraqis that most Americans and Canadians have been exposed to through the mainstream media. She spoke in Vancouver on June 11, 2008. Listeners can see her photo essays, as well as supporting documents, on her website at www.liberatethis.com.
So the new Iraq genocide, unfortunately, this is what we're facing now under American control in Iraq. The death toll since 2003 in Darfur, Sudan, is less than half of what has happened in Iraq. And that is something that, for political reasons, the Bush administration has chosen to term a genocide. Well, with more than double that in Iraq, I feel comfortable in calling it a genocide in 5 years' time. Iraqis who have lived their entire lives in Iraq are stunned by the violence that's come in on the backs of the invaders. They don't know who's responsible for the violence and the death toll, so it is the epitome of the arrogance of empire for us to say this was Sunni, this was Shia, this was Al-Qaeda, this was whatever. People there don't know what's happening. But they do know who's responsible for their safety, and that is, by international law, the occupying force, the Americans, and they hold us responsible. The most important reason for my website is to back up what I say, because my message is so vastly different from what's in the mainstream media. So I have a section called Further Reading. I think I back it up pretty well, but it's organized by category, and so I hope you'll check it out. So as I said, just a warning, I am going to show you images of occupation. And by the end of this, it is going to be intense, but this is about, you spend a couple hours with me tonight, and then we'll go to our homes and kind of decompress. But Iraqis have no respite from the suffering and no end in sight. So I'm going to cover a little bit of background, both Iraq and my own. We'll talk about the devastation of the first Gulf War, which is the foundation upon which we built Shock and Awe, and how things only got worse during Shock and Awe, but I want to close on our goal of ending the occupation so that healing can begin. Now, this is a picture of George Bush. This is back in March of 2004. Now, every year in the United States, there's a Radio and Television Correspondents Association dinner, which should send off red flags to the American people, because the media is supposed to be the watchdog of the government, not the lapdog of the government. So that a black tie affair in Washington every spring is really not what we want to be seeing. But nevertheless, the tradition is that the president will stand up and give remarks that are a comedy routine. Well, last year, this dinner took place shortly after the shootings that happened at Virginia Tech. And so out of respect for the families, George Bush decided he would not do the comedy routine. But back in March 2004, 1 year after illegally invading Iraq, over 100,000 Iraqis are dead, over 500 American servicemen and women are dead, he didn't have a problem cracking jokes. And he and his staff had taken pictures in the Oval Office, looking under furniture, behind doors, and they showed, this is one of the slides they showed, I got it off the internet, saying those weapons of mass destruction have got to be here somewhere. And then you see Joe Lieberman laughing in the audience. A lot of people thought that was funny. Probably this young man isn't laughing that he was sent to fight a war based on lies. 21 years old, sent to Iraq, stepped on a landmine, lost both his legs and his right arm. And this young man probably isn't laughing that there were no weapons of mass destruction. RPG went through his right leg. He is now disabled, now dependent on a VA system to help take care of him for the rest of his life. And probably this British soldier isn't laughing at the moment he's trying to save his life from a burning tank in Basra. And four Iraqis, 5 years of a brutal and bloody occupation. And as I said, no end in sight. And let me back up a little bit, because this is something that most Americans, I think, can't make the connection to, because we funnel our money into cruise missiles rather than education, but bear with me. This is, of course, the land of Mesopotamia is the Fertile Crescent, and you see it outlined in green in this image. This is between 2000 and 3000 BC. And in the lower right corner, you see the major early civilizations. Here's Sumer, Ur, and Babylon. This, of course, the Tigris and Euphrates, Mesopotamia. And just as a historical point, between 2000 and 3000 BC, this over here is Palestine. Israel was a state created in 1940. The biblical Garden of Eden, that's in the location, is in modern-day Iraq. Abraham, father of the three major monotheistic religions, was from Ur. Now, my dad says Abraham was an Iraqi. That might be pushing it a little bit, but nevertheless, this is a connection that many of us have to this part of the world. But that's not what they were talking about when we were getting ready to rain bombs on Iraq. As I said, the major early civilizations, these are the people who devised the concept of the 24-hour day. First system of writing, a basis of mathematics. You see, these are Arabic numerals that we use. The basis of law, science, and medicine, actually 7,000 years of civilization. And it was all accomplished without the help of any Americans or British. It's true. It's true. This is a pictorial of what the Hanging Gardens of Babylon may have looked like, built by Nebuchadnezzar II in 600 BC, for many years respected as one of the seven wonders of the world. It was not built by Halliburton. So, if you're concerned about what will happen with Iraqi reconstruction after American troops and American businesses leave, I have a feeling that the descendants of the people who did this can probably throw something together. It's gonna be all right. Don't worry. My dad, originally from Basra, Iraq, Iraq's second largest city in the south, near the border with Kuwait. Born and raised there, graduated from secondary school, and went on to Baghdad University College of Education in the sciences. And he graduated from there in 1961, doing well enough to earn a government scholarship to do his graduate studies overseas. So he ended up coming to Washington, D.C., was studying in the D.C. area, where he met another graduate student, a nice Jewish girl from New York. Now, take-home message is, with an Arab father and Jewish mother, although those groups are not mutually exclusive, there are many Arab Jews, but with an Arab father and an Ashkenazi Jewish mother, I am 100% Semite. So if you like, you can insult either side of my family, and that would be anti-Semitic, but if you could hold it for the Q&A, that would be great. But let's build on this unity. Now, this is me, 6 months old, and this is in our backyard in Iraq. After my dad finished his PhD in August of 71, he had to pay back that government scholarship by teaching at Basra University for 5 years. So the first 5 years of my life were back and forth between Iraq and the States. So for any of us, the memories we have of our childhood from before the time that our brains could make memories are from the pictures. So you talk to me about Iraq, I think of this, sitting in our backyard living there. But if you see the walls like this, the standard architecture in Iraq are these yellow brick walls. And you will often see American military vehicles slamming into these walls to destroy them. It doesn't mean there's necessarily like something like a hideout or a huge weapons cache that's being hid there. It just means that that's what the architecture is. That's a house. So we left in 1977. My dad always intended that we would go back at least for a visit. But in 1980, the Iran-Iraq War started. That lasted for 8 years. At that point, I'm a junior in high school. It's not really possible for us to, not as easy for us to travel. Before you know it, August 2nd, 1990 rolls around, and without consulting my family, Saddam Hussein moved troops into Kuwait. And 4 days later, economic sanctions were imposed. 5 months later, the Gulf War happened, which was 42 consecutive days of bombing. Now, I no longer live on the East Coast because I really can't handle the weather that you guys experience. I don't like three consecutive days of rain. But we bombed them for 42 straight days. And so their ability to survive boggles my mind. What followed was 13 years of sanctions, and really the only reason I have family to visit today is because my father was in the States earning a salary and able to send them money so that they could buy food. So then came the lead up to shock and awe, and the invasion happened, and I was like, we keep waiting for things to get better, and they just keep getting worse. So I'm going to go ahead and go. And that was a little bit stupid, but it worked out fine. So I returned in February, March of 2004, visiting Baghdad for the first time and meeting most of the family I was meeting was, I'd never met them before. I hadn't been to Baghdad, so I didn't know that distant family. And most of my cousins were born after we'd left in 77. So here I'm meeting my dad's one half-brother. Well, they lived in Baghdad. They are now scattered in Syria and Jordan. But they're fortunate. They had the financial means to leave and somewhere to go. Not everybody is so lucky, but they would have liked to. I mean, I know he would like to live his final days out in his homeland, but that's not really possible at the moment. My uncle is a retired lawyer now, 86 years old. Two of his granddaughters, my cousins, Dina, who graduated from the School of Translation. So I was lucky that, you know, wherever I was, that, you know, they had learned enough English that we didn't have to rely on my Arabic. But so that's Dina, and then Noor, she has a baby face, but she's now probably 22 years old. She was a second year student in economics. Both of them went to Al-Mustansiriya University, the oldest university in the world. But again, now they're refugees in Jordan and Syria. My dad is actually one of 10 kids. My dad's number 5. This uncle is number 6. Growing up, they were very close, and they have very similar features. In the 1960s, this uncle played for the Iraqi national soccer team. You see the Olympic rings on his jersey. So very strong, very athletic. You know, ultimately, when he retired in 1970 from soccer, he took a job with the port. Most people in Basra work for the port. But I'm very fortunate, knock on wood, that he is still alive, although he's suffering today. He has congestive heart failure, and there is no such thing as an echocardiogram in Iraq. There is no such thing as a CAT scan machine. There isn't even basic evaluation. So again, because my father can send money, he went to Tehran to go get healthcare provided. So he's still alive. But the years of war and occupation have taken their toll. And while I'm very lucky he's still here, this is what my uncle looks like today. It's people who pay the price, whether it's the families of the over 4,100, actually over 4,600 American soldiers who've died in a war based on lies. Because in that Pentagon tally, they don't count who's died in Afghanistan. And you actually have to die in the sands of Iraq to be counted. Families paid the price, like the people of New Orleans, who have yet to be able to return home almost 3 years after Hurricane Katrina hit, because while we spend $1 billion on an illegal occupation, there's just not enough money for reconstruction at home. Whether it's the 26 million Iraqis who paid the price. So throughout all of this, what gives people hope, the same thing that gives us people hope, are the kids, you know, the next generation that comes along. Typically, when you will see images of Arabs or Muslims in the media, you will see young military-aged men. They are often dressed in black. They often have the chafia over their face to hide their identity. They're often marching, carrying weapons, and they are chanting in unison in a language that most of us can't understand. This is the image that bombards the American people on a regular basis. Now that is a subliminal message that these people are not like us, because do the math with me. Any country, any population you pick, about half male, half female. Add up the women, the girls, and the boys. The majority of any population are women and children. And when we don't see those images in the mainstream media to balance the negative images that we're bombarded with, it's a subliminal message that they're just not like us. I can't put my finger on it, but they're just not like us. In reality, it is the women and children who pay the highest price whenever there's no law and order. And if we would connect the dots, we'd recognize that that's why those young men are angry. Now, was Iraq a threat to us? Probably, I'm sure this audience is with me. And most people, even the hardest core Americans, are probably willing to accept now that no, Iraq was not a threat to us. But one of the reasons for that was our use of depleted uranium since the first Gulf War. Now, depleted uranium, just briefly, many of you are probably familiar with it, but let me tell you, American audiences, they just don't know what it is. But I try to explain to them that this is basically our generation's Agent Orange. It's radioactive waste, because when Canada or the United States or any other country mines uranium for the purpose of nuclear power, nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, only 0.7% of what is mined is usable for the purpose of that nuclear power. The other 99.3% is garbage. And we have it stockpiled in the United States. I think you have some stores here as well. But come visit me in Colorado. We got nuclear missile silos. We got depleted uranium. It's a great place. What the Pentagon found was that this leftover depleted uranium, depleted because it no longer has the valuable isotope that we use for energy, it's the most dense material on Earth. So what they found was when they formulated it into rods and put it in missiles and aimed those missiles at tanks, it cuts through a tank like a hot knife through butter, which is very exciting if you are the Pentagon. Not very exciting for anybody else. But what happens on impact is that the depleted uranium, which is also on 50 millimeter artillery rounds, also in artillery shells, also some missiles are tipped with it, it on impact bursts into flames. And it aerosolizes, like spraying an aerosol spray can. The particles go and you can't see them anymore. They're microscopic. It goes into the air and the sand and the water supply for the civilian population. This is tons of microscopic contamination, and uranium is radioactive. So this is radioactive contamination for the world, essentially. Concentrated in the areas we've used it, but we have wind currents that will take it all the way around. Now, Major Doug Rocky was the Pentagon's go-to guy to investigate our use of DU. And after the first Gulf War, that was the first time we used it, dropping over 300 tons during that six-week conflict. And his determination was that the civilian population was exposed, American soldiers were exposed, so that recommendations were, first of all, you never should have used this in the first place. Don't ever use it again. Second of all, you have to provide the civilians with education on what you've done to them. And third, the returning veterans need to be tested, because if they have medical problems resulting from that exposure, that's service-related disability, and they're entitled to benefits. Well, the blood test for depleted uranium is $1,000 a test. We can't afford that in the United States, at least according to Dick Cheney, so that was cut out of the VA budget. And as for the rest of it, the Pentagon said, Doug, thank you very much, you're fired. So to this day now, it's estimated somewhere over 2,000 tons have been used in Iraq. But we used it first in 1991, the first Gulf War. Again, we provided it for the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. Again, Afghanistan through today, and then bombing Iraq from the Gulf War through the 90s and shock and awe through today. The tiny victims of Desert Storm, basically depleted uranium as a radioactive agent affects children most of all, because they're growing, their cells are dividing, and if you introduce radiation into that, it screws it up. Now this is a Life Special Edition photo essay. I have a category on my website called Depleted Uranium, and this photo essay is linked to it. But this is what you'll find there. Basically, significant increase of congenital abnormalities in the children of veterans of Desert Storm, who had had normal children prior to their service. This little one born without arms and legs. This is the presentation as if the mother had taken thalidomide, which was an anti-nausea medication, but that's not, this mom hadn't taken it, and there was no history of this deformity in the family. This little one has spina bifida. That's failure of the spinal column, the neural tube, to close during development. She will never walk. And this little one has Goldenhar syndrome. Now this is a rare syndrome, and you can see some of the characteristics of it. You see his skull is misshapen because of that. Depending on how it's malformed, there's a loss of hearing or vision. Of course, you can't see that there's dextrocardia, which is the heart is on the wrong side. There are other musculoskeletal and neurological abnormalities. Now what's important about Goldenhar's is that this very rare syndrome, there's a cluster of cases among the children of Gulf War veterans. Now they started to investigate it, but the money ran out. And in all the billions that have been appropriated for continuing the occupation, they've yet to further investigate this disease. Now for Iraqis, you have an entire population, which was really, after the first Gulf War, was concentrated in southern Iraq, unfortunately Basra, where my family is. It's the most likely etiology of the 600% increase in Iraq's infant mortality rate after the first Gulf War, and 300% increase in the incidence of pediatric leukemias and lymphomas. the pediatricians were seeing, having new cancer diagnoses at a rate they had never seen before since the first Gulf War. And the congenital malformations became so common that mothers stopped asking when the child was born, is it a boy or a girl? They asked, is it normal? You see this little one, obviously has an IV in place and has the typical appearance of getting some chemotherapy. But what was happening in Iraq, thanks to economic sanctions, blocked Iraq from selling oil, I'll come back to that, but also blocked the entry of really most products, including pharmaceuticals, was that because of the argument of dual use, that a chemotherapeutic agent used to treat a pediatric cancer might be used to manufacture chemical weapons, despite the fact that there was no evidence that that could be done. But pediatric leukemias and lymphomas have an excellent cure rate. There's a lot of money that goes into research for that. So they have a very high cure rate if you have availability of drugs. Now, this child obviously is getting one round of drugs, but what would happen is you need multiple rounds of multiple drugs, and they would not have the other rounds to give. So the fatality rate on the pediatric ward in Basra Women and Children's Hospital during sanctions was 100%.
Dalia Wasfi speaks about the human costs of the war and occupation of Iraq, particularly on the health of Iraqis and of American soldiers returning from that war, and on the public health infrastructure of Iraq.
Uranium mining. Getting the uranium to begin with, this is mostly it happens from underground or open pit mines. And radioactive damage, it's already been found that that happens to the environment and public health in the area where these mines are. A lot of it comes from radioactive dust that comes from the mining area, as well as contaminated rainwater, which then if animals eat it, and if you're eating animals, then it goes to the food chain. More than 50% of the world's production of uranium is coming from Canada and Australia. Northern Saskatchewan is the world's largest, most concentrated uranium reserves. And it's already been established that fisheries in the area have been poisoned, and it's threatened the indigenous communities. In the U.S. as well, we use the reservation areas where the Native Americans are living as a testing ground for uranium mining and uranium explosions. Uranium refining, that's another step in the process of getting uranium to the usable part for nuclear power. Port Hope, Ontario has the oldest uranium processing facility in the world. Now back in the early 1940s, all the uranium that was processed in Port Hope was delivered to the United States for the Manhattan Project. I regret the complicity in the probably one of the greatest war crimes so far committed by the United States of America. And there's many to choose from. This is in Port Hope, and you see that, you know, this is the refinery, this is someone's house, here's a play set, here are the kids sitting over here, and this tarp over here is supposed to protect the dust from coming out. The Cameco Corporation. This was established several years ago through the privatization of Canada's uranium industry, along combining with El Dorado Nuclear and also merged Saskatchewan Mining Development Corporation. This is one of the four companies that provides uranium for the Western world, and you guys have the largest. Canada, it's Cameco. In the United States, it's Honeywell. In UK, it's British Nuclear Fuels Limited. And in France, it's Comerhex. Now, if you look at the company you're keeping, United States, Great Britain, and France, look, do you know what these colonial powers have done? You don't want to be associated with us, all right? Let me encourage you to separate. 85% of the uranium that's mined here in Canada gets exported. And it goes to the United States and France and Britain, where the enrichment plants are primarily military facilities. There's like a civilian, might be a civilian cover, but by and large, the money that keeps the ball rolling is military. Some of that, when it gets refined, it comes back to Canada, but the majority is converted to weapons-grade material. And again, because so little, as I mentioned, so little is usable for nuclear power, over 80% of what is exported becomes depleted uranium stores. So unfortunately, you are helping to supply us with what we're using in Iraq and Afghanistan. These numbers are from the Canada Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Now, very recently, this is good news for British Columbia. British Columbia banned uranium exploration. which is really good, but right now there are no mines here. So that's good. There won't be mines here, even if somebody discovers it by accident. But we're a long way from extricating Canada from basically the kill cycle that arms the U.S. Was Iraq a threat to us? No, Iraq was not a threat to us. And another major reason was that in the first Gulf War, the public health infrastructure was decimated. Iraq's medical system was once known as the jewel of the Arab world. A first-class range of facilities, really a first-world system of medicine, so much so that Iraq had a whole tourist industry where people were coming to Iraq to have their healthcare needs met. And it was a socialist system, so it was paid for. But what happened was American planes and British planes targeted the infrastructure of Iraq, which is illegal. Because that's targeting the civilian population. That's a little something called the Geneva Conventions, which is optional where I come from, but just so I lay it out for you. And what happened was, with damage to the infrastructure, because we targeted water sewage treatment plants, there was massive disease outbreak. Primary health care and preventative services, basic general practitioner care, ceased to exist. And this is the report that documented it in 2003. In addition, we bombed the electrical grids. So if you imagine very good medical care in Canada, you take out the electrical grids, what does that do to your healthcare system? You can't run ventilators. You cannot run surgical suites. You cannot run IV pumps. You cannot function as a first world medical system. It takes you out of commission. And that's what we did, we, United States and Great Britain, did to Iraq. A World Health Organization report that ironically came out on the day Shock and Awe started noted that the three major causes of morbidity and mortality for children under 5 in Iraq were easily treatable diseases. Acute lower respiratory infections, diarrheal disease, and then vaccine-preventable diseases like the measles. Respiratory infections and diarrhea were accounting for 70% of the deaths of children under 5. And Iraqis knew this, and they knew who was responsible. The increase in respiratory infections in the early 1990s was due to sanctions, food insecurity, inadequate feeding practices, malnutrition, lack of access to quality health services, combined with population displacement and overcrowding. And I want you to keep that in mind, because this has all escalated exponentially since the Shock and Awe invasion, because you have a refugee crisis of over 5 million. Diarrheal disease, cholera, became endemic in Iraq, and there happened to be outbreaks that coincide with American bombing campaigns. Dysentery was prevalent, again, due to destruction of the infrastructure. Was Iraq a threat to us? No, Iraq was not a threat to us. Except that Saddam Hussein wanted to start using the euro, but that's another story. But another reason is because of economic sanctions, which I've already talked to you about. Imposed on Iraq on August 6, 1990, in a bitter irony, on the anniversary of another targeting of the civilian population 45 years before the bombing of Hiroshima. What we did with sanctions, the most stringent sanctions ever, blocked the sale of oil. This was punishment for moving troops into Kuwait. And this was 95% of their economy. Blocked the import of goods, as I already told you, and with the infrastructure destroyed, this inhibited reconstruction and inhibited healthcare and basic survival for the people. By 1995, 4 years of sanctions, UNICEF reported that it was yielding a minimum of political dividends against a high human price paid primarily by women and children. I mean, I asked my audiences, what would Americans do if another country's policies were targeting women and children? We would flip out, I guarantee you. The food rationing system, which had been was begun when sanctions started by the regime, was providing less than 60% of the required daily caloric intake. That food rationing system continues to this day. It's what families are depending on, many families are depending on for basic survival, and the new government in Iraq is eliminating it. Water and sanitation systems are in a state of collapse, and there's a critical shortage of life-saving drugs. So what happened when this report came out was this was the impetus for the Oil for Food program, which was supposed to begin in December 1996, and of course was rife with corruption, as many programs are. 1997, another UNICEF study shows that nearly 1 million children in southern and central Iraq are chronically malnourished. An increase of 72% since 1991. So this is not just an accident. This is a policy affecting by far the majority of children. It is clear that children are bearing the brunt of the current economic hardship. And I'll show you through the medical system what was happening, because we weren't allowing goods to come in. This little one has scoliosis. This brace doesn't really fit him, but this is the best they have to offer him. And these little ones, obviously you can see the malnutrition. You can see anywhere between 2 and 5 babies in one incubator. Why? Number one, they fit. Number two, if an incubator breaks down, you have to consolidate because there aren't the materials because of sanctions to repair or replace that incubator. Number three, when the rolling blackouts come and you're going to run a generator, it requires less fuel to run one incubator than two. So this is the malnutrition that American foreign policy brought to Iraq. And unfortunately, this is where most of Iraq's children were ending up, with an estimated 5,000 deaths every month. Now, I just want to point out to you that this picture is from February 2003. Now, here we come to Shock and Awe. So Shock and Awe was not just a catchy phrase. It was actually a position paper written by Harlan Ullman and James Wade. Harlan Ullman is a professor at the National War College. I'm exceedingly embarrassed that we have a National War College in the United States. And Colin Powell is one of his students. But Shock and Awe, what basically achieving rapid dominance, this is a how-to for terrorism. Basically, how do you assault a population so that they will submit to your agenda? And in it, Ullman describes, you have this simultaneous effect, rather like the nuclear weapons at Hiroshima, not taking days or weeks, but in minutes. Super tools and weapons, information age equivalents of the atomic bomb, have to be invented. As the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki finally convinced the Japanese emperor and high command that even suicidal resistance was futile, these tools must be directed towards a similar outcome. This is who is developing American military policy. Now, when we dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, we incinerated 92,000 people. This, by the way, is something that we have yet to apologize for. And that's not even talking about the radiation sickness and the cancers that followed. We leveled 4.7 square miles of the city. And the American government knew what it had done. It went in to see what it had done. What was its response? It did the same thing to Nagasaki 3 days later. Also have yet to apologize for. Now, this is one of my pictures. These are nieces of one of my dad's former students. And their aunt told me that they screamed during Shock and Awe. So we accomplished that mission. We terrorized them. But actually, they were lucky. Because for this little one, an American cruise missile hit her home in Basra, and she was crushed to death. Let me introduce you to her sister, 10 years old. This is the reality of American foreign policy. So these are our victims. Again, and in Iraq, half the population are under 18. This is what war and occupation looked like. So as my government saber rattles towards Iran, as all major candidates saber rattle towards Iran, this is the image that I want them to have in their mind. Is this what we need to do to Iranian women and children, or North Korean women and children, or Syrian women and children? That's the reality. This is in Fallujah. Now, we've often heard, especially in 2004 during the sieges, that Fallujah was filled with foreign fighters who were crossing the border to come kill Americans. Well, this little one never learned how to walk, so unlikely he was a foreign fighter. But you see the desperate circumstances. There's no sheets on the bed. Nobody's wearing gloves. This child is dying and did die after this picture was taken. And this is the grief that we don't see in the media. And so that's why people can't understand. When they just see the angry men marching around, they're very violent. It's a very violent culture. Not so much. If that isn't the pot calling the kettle black for Americans to condemn the actions of anybody else as violent. Now, I just want to pause for a moment for cluster bombs. Now, this is something that, once again, Americans are responsible for this continuing to be a problem, because in the last year or two, there was an international vote to ban the production and sale of cluster bombs. 48 countries said, that's a great idea, we're with you. One country said, don't do it, United States of America. Now, cluster bombs are basically, they're cylinders dropped from planes, and in midair, the cylinder opens and drops a number of these bomblets that, on impact with the ground, are supposed to shatter into 200 or 300 razor-sharp shrapnel fragments. But what happens sometimes is that they don't hit at the right angle, or they don't hit with enough force, and they don't detonate. So they sit there, basically acting as a landmine, until someone comes to trigger it. Now, that will usually be a child, because an adult is going to be wary of something like that. Now, cluster bombs do not discriminate between military and civilian targets, which makes them against international law, but again, that's considered optional where I come from. So what happens with the cluster bombs? Now, what you see on your left is what a cluster bomb looks like. What you see on your right is an American food ration packet. You mean to tell me nobody could sort out that you should probably color them differently? So kids learn that the Americans will bring food. This is what you should look for. And God forbid they pick up the wrong thing, and this is what happens. Massive injuries. And this is in the last 3 days of the Israeli bombing of Lebanon in the summer of 2006. The Israelis unloaded over 1 million cluster bombs, which then, of course, led to an epidemic of cluster bomb injuries. For that time, up to 40% did not detonate, probably because they were older. Iraqi hospitals ailing under occupation. This is a report from 2005. It's difficult at this point to get more up-to-date and accurate numbers because of the chaos in Iraq today. But this is from 2005, and Dar Jamil was there, did a survey of 13 hospitals in Baghdad over a 9-month period. And what they found was lack of equipment and resources, thanks to sanctions and looting. Sanctions before the invasion, looting after the invasion, was a major issue, and no funds were coming from the U.S.-operated Ministry of Health. And of course, with war and occupation, you have an increased number of patients. Arabic Children's Hospital. As I told you, the majority of new pediatric cancer cases were concentrated in southern Iraq after the first Gulf War. Now, with bombings of Baghdad that increased in number, now for the first time they see increased rates in Baghdad. Now, epidemiologic studies are not really possible. Again, no resources. They can't even stock the hospitals, and no security to conduct an accurate study. Doctors say we are getting less medical supplies now than we were during the sanctions. Before the invasion, we had a much better supply situation, 80% better than now, and no money is coming from reconstruction. This is why most Iraqis, I would say at this point, most Iraqis, you ask Iraqis, are you better off now than before the invasion? And they will tell you, no way. Yeah, it sucked under Saddam. Yeah, that's, we know that, but we had law and order. We had electricity. We had water. And you could go out in the street, and you had health care, and you had education. All that is gone now under American direction. Here's a little something called the Geneva Conventions that I usually have to introduce to my American audiences. But Article 55 and 56 say that the occupying military is not supposed to interfere with civilian health care. But again, this is really the rules of engagement are really more about liability than morality. And they're changing all the time. In April of 2004, at Fallujah General Hospital, Marines closed the bridge to the city and the hospital road. The U.S. military and its vehicles were at the hospital entrance. So if you were shot by a Marine, are you going to go try to get through other Marines to go get medical care? Snipers were on the rooftops targeting ambulances and the clinic entrance. This is an ambulance, 5 bullet holes in the driver's side. What we do, what the United States military does, is we come in with airstrikes first. This is also a mini shock and awe campaign to root out insurgents. And when you hear that we've hit insurgent safe houses, I guarantee you the pilot cannot see who is inside that house. And most of the time, it's women and children who are trying to stay out of the violence in the street. This woman, you see blood on her headscarf. This is a sniper shot. Snipers are taught to shoot to kill. One in the head, or two in the chest, or one in the neck. Your great vessels are here, your airway is here. That's a shot to kill, but she was a civilian. She died after this photo was taken. Now, this man probably had a scalp injury, okay? Now, if any of you have cut your scalp, you know, it bleeds like stink, because the scalp is highly vascularized, a lot of blood vessels. And this guy, because of mass casualties, because of lack of resources, lack of personnel, and chaos, he probably may have bled out from a wound that was not, should not have been fatal. And this is why the death toll in Iraq is so high, because people cannot get health care. They cannot get taken care of, in addition to the fact that we're bombing them and shooting them and training death squads. This little one, again, injured in the pre-invasion bombing raids, died after this photo was taken. And so dead children is a big reason why people don't like us. Ambulance with bullet holes in the back, though it's clearly written in English. This was an ambulance. This is clearly a war crime. And this was a soccer field that had to be converted to a cemetery. Fallujah Cemetery is on the outskirts of the town. And when people went to go bury the dead, to keep within Islamic tradition of do it within 24 hours, Fallujah was declared a free fire zone. So the U.S. military determined that anything that was still there was an insurgent and so could get shot at. So every time they went to bury people, they would get shot at. This soccer field was adjacent to the clinic in Fallujah, and so they just converted it. And many of the children buried here were the ones who played here. This is what post-traumatic stress disorder looks like. Every American should ask themselves, what does this kid know of America? And should we be surprised if he joins the resistance in a couple of years? This is hospital in Fallujah. And again, this is the grief that we don't see. And it's so easy to dehumanize. I know this is where it gets intense, but again, this is where we came back and we were unrelenting against the Iraqi people. We came back in November 2004. It's estimated that between 600 and 800 civilians were killed in the April siege of Fallujah. It's estimated that between 6,000 and 8,000 civilians were killed in the November siege of Fallujah, which means that the Iraqi death toll in Fallujah alone, in November 2004 alone, is greater than all of Operation Enduring Freedom for the Coalition of the Willing thus far.
Dr. Dalia Wasfi speaks about the human costs of the war and occupation of Iraq. In this portion of the talk, she urges members of the audience to speak up and demand an end to this war.
Again, preceded by airstrikes, the Nizal Emergency Hospital, supposed to be protected by the Geneva Conventions, leveled to the ground, and the Fallujah General Hospital was seized. Now, I understand what's happening, generally speaking, what's happening in this picture. Whenever soldiers are entering an area, whether it be a hospital or a house, they need to secure the area for the safety of themselves and their unit. So what they will do is they will round up, if there are men and women, they'll round them up and separate them. And basically secure any threat. So, of course, any Iraqi military-aged male is a threat to their security, potential threat. But I also want to point out that these Iraqi military-aged men are wearing scrubs, they're in white coats, and he's got a stethoscope around his neck. Okay, so I thought my residency was hard, but this is what doctors face in Iraq. So what happens when the U.S. pulls out? This crap stops. We were tied up and beaten despite being unarmed and having only our medical instruments. And it was reported that troops dragged patients from their beds and pushed them against the wall. I was with a woman in labor. The umbilical cord had not yet been cut. At that time, a U.S. soldier shouted at one of the Iraqi National Guards to arrest me and tie my hands while I was helping the mother to deliver. Brain drain in Iraq today. Now, this is something that happens often when America shows up in another country. You get rid of the people who are going to threaten your agenda. This is what we did in Latin America. This is how we helped Saddam Hussein come to power in the 1960s, and this is what we're doing in Iraq today. Targeted assassinations, over 1,000 intellectuals now, academics and healthcare workers have been eliminated. And as I mentioned, the CIA found a young man who they thought would toe their line in the 1960s. It was the socialists versus the communists coming to power, and we weren't about to let the communists come to power with all that oil sitting there. So our CIA fed the names of communists and leftist intellectuals to Saddam Hussein, and that's how his killing sprees started, on our dime, with our help. December 20th, 1983. Ladies and gentlemen, can you feel the love in this picture? Donald Rumsfeld, private citizen, special envoy to President Reagan, reaffirming our close ties with our ally in the region. This was, of course, before we were dealing arms to the Iranians, but that's another story. And you can see that Saddam Hussein, the Iran-Iraq war, is well underway at this point. He's using the chemical and biological and conventional weapons and satellite intelligence that we're providing him with. By the way, the crimes for which Saddam Hussein was executed, 1982. This is December 20th, 1983. Yeah, he's a brutal dictator, but he's our brutal dictator. What healthcare system today? This is a very good article. It's linked from my website. Medics beg for help as Iraqis die needlessly. This is almost 2 years old now, but this is the best that I've come across so far. It doesn't mean there's not more out there. It's just what I found. More than half of physicians have left the country because of targeting for kidnapping, ransom, and murders. 2,000 estimated murdered since the invasion, 250 kidnapped, an estimated 164 nurses murdered. All of these numbers are up now. This is my favorite statistic. $243 million American tax dollars set aside by the U.S. administration to build 142 private health clinics in Iraq. The number of clinics actually built by April 2006, 20. The amount of money left, nothing. The amount of clinics opened, zero. 70% of child deaths continue to be caused by easily treatable conditions. 270,000 children, that's the estimate, between the invasion and October 2006 have had no access to immunization. Health indicators for a society, 68% of Iraqis have no access to safe drinking water, only 19% have access to proper sewerage, and the sewage is running in the streets. Post-traumatic stress disorder, I alluded to it earlier with a picture, but this is really another lecture, probably a seminar. And when we hear about it in the United States, it's in the context, and it's rare that we hear about it, but it's in the context of occupation soldiers who are now serving two or three or four tours of duty. The Pentagon says that one out of three soldiers will come home with post-traumatic stress disorder. I will tell you that three out of three soldiers come home with post-traumatic stress disorder. Nobody's coming home the same. I was in Iraq for 3 months with my family, and it took 6 months for me to recover, and I was not in a combat zone. When those soldiers come home, the strapped Veterans Administration healthcare system cannot take care of them. If you go in, and it's very difficult because they've been trained to be very macho and strong and thank you, sir, may I have another. But if they cut to the point where they're going to go and say, you know what, I'm thinking about hurting myself, I want to kill myself, they'll get like, okay, we could probably get you an appointment in about 2 to 6 months. Okay, well, that's great. So in that time, if they don't kill themselves, what will happen is they will self-medicate. That's just the human response. That leads to alcohol abuse, drug abuse, domestic violence, then suicidality, homicidality. In the United States, we have homeless veterans on the street who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. 38% of the homeless in a country that whose mantra is support the troops are veterans. That's the reality in the United States. So don't follow our example. The VA healthcare system, as I mentioned, cannot handle it. And you're talking about a pool now for Iraq and Afghanistan alone of about 1.6 million. In Iraq, you have 26 million who are traumatized. And this is going to take decades or generations to overcome. The unbearable suffering of Iraqis, this was a report submitted by the Red Cross, because of mass casualties, malnutrition, power and water shortages that have worsened, become more frequent since the Americans have showed up, noting that the plight of Iraqi civilians is a daily reminder of the fact that there has long been a failure to respect their lives and dignity. Also from this article, Saad, a humanitarian worker, is quoted as recalling the scene after a bomb blast. I saw a four-year-old boy sitting beside his mother's body, which had been decapitated by the explosion. He was talking to her, asking her what had happened. This story is heartbreaking, but it is a metaphor for what has happened in Iraq. The United States and Great Britain invaded illegally. They devastated civil society. They brought chaos and violence, which is the comparison is the car bombing. They decapitated the leadership, executing the only established government, and the people are asking, what the hell is going on? What's happened here? What do we do? My friends, it's so simple. Immediate and unconditional withdrawal of foreign military forces from Iraq and Afghanistan, period. As I like to tell my audiences in the United States, we have as much a role in the healing of Iraq and Afghanistan as the Gestapo did in Poland and Czechoslovakia. We have no role and no credibility. But this is what I usually get back. Well, it'll get worse when we leave. There'll be civil war. As if we got such a good thing going now, we don't want to mess it up. Okay, the reality is that there will be civil war. It's pretty much been guaranteed. Because we invaded illegally, we executed the leadership, we dissolved civil society, we devastated the infrastructure, there's chaos, there's no law and order, and there's a power vacuum. Now, as long as there have been power vacuums, there will be a battle for power. And as long as it's been men leading the charge, it's happened violently. I don't know that we would have a bake-off if women were in charge. I'm just saying we don't know yet. That's how it's happened. And in the United States, we had a civil war after we kicked out the occupier, and then we moved on. But when people say that to you, it's like, oh, no, it's so bad now, it'll get worse when we leave. Well, that's counterintuitive, because they were better off before we showed up. And when we leave, there's a few things I can guarantee you. Number one, no more bombing raids. It's only American and British planes in the sky. And in 2004, that was the number one cause of civilian morbidity and mortality, because as I said, it's women and children in their homes hiding from the violence in the street. Number two, it's the end of American-run prisons in Iraq. I have an article linked from my website, I think under the category occupation, of an interview of a guy who did time in Abu Ghraib under Saddam, did time in Abu Ghraib under the Americans. The Americans are worse. Now, we're all about winning in the United States, but this was not a contest we wanted to come out on top of. The International Red Cross, Red Crescent, estimates that between 70 and 90% of those Iraqi military-aged males who've been incarcerated have been arrested by mistake. Yeah, the military says, well, they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah, they were in Iraq when the Americans invaded. And when we leave, there's no more rape and torture that continues. Even though the Abu Ghraib scandal came to light in 2004, nothing's changed to this day. I don't have time to go into it. We can talk about it in the Q&A if you want. But the same apparatus of death squads that the United States and its CIA established in the 1980s in Latin America has been set up in Iraq. Not just the same structure. It's the same people. From John Negroponte to Stephen Castile to ex-captain, Army Captain James Steele, it's the same people. In the 1980s, Nicaragua and Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador were characterized by disappearances, torture, death squads, and blood in the streets and bodies turning up. Sound familiar? That's Iraq today. And it's the same people involved. So when the funding of that leaves, that's a good thing. Finally, it's the end of the murder, rape, and torture of Iraqis by Americans. And I guarantee you this. You bring the troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they will stop dying there. And that is the only thing that will accomplish that mission. We have to stay and help. Now, I'm not Iraqi. My dad's from Iraq, but I'm an American. But I feel comfortable in saying, on behalf of the Iraqi people, that they've had just about all the help they can take from the United States of America. For Iraqis, American help is economic sanctions that killed between 1.2 and 1.8 million. We are using napalm, we are using white phosphorus, we are using depleted uranium. In the United States, we have technically less than 300 years of history, and that's not a democratic history, and that was really founded on the slaughter of the indigenous peoples. In Iraq, they have more than 7,000 years of civilization. Who needs whose help? And by the way, the Americans are not really the ones to be exporting democracy around the world, if you've seen our last few elections. Now, I ask these questions because there is an element of white man's burden in this driving, this need to stay and help. What if Iraqis were white? What if they were a 94% Christian country instead of a 94% Muslim country? What if they spoke Oxford English? Well, some of them do, but it didn't stop us. But the reality is, there is racism involved in that. The war on terror is a war of terror. It's genocide. And we are all responsible, of course, I'm usually speaking to American audiences, from the privates who carry out illegal orders, which they are obligated to refuse, to the chicken hawks who issue those illegal orders, to you and me, because unfortunately, that's what our governments have done. They've done all this in our name, and we're not helping in Iraq. I want to leave you with images of Iraqi unity that you will not find in the mainstream media, because that's the reality that's on the ground. Iraqis see themselves as Iraqis first. Their religious, ethnic, sectarian differences come after that. It seems that the Americans didn't need to teach Iraqis how to demonstrate against illegal occupation. They figured it out. And I love this picture because this is the American tank, and here's the foreign press. Now, this picture is from a couple of years ago, and I thought, well, you know, probably it's so dangerous now, these demonstrations aren't happening anymore. These people are fighting for their lives. April 2007, this is public worker protest. Though it was illegal, Paul Bremer threw out the majority of the laws of the Ba'athist regime. One of the laws he kept was the law banning unions. And the Iraqis said, no way. We will seek to protect our resources. And here, the fastest construction project going on in Iraq is dividing Baghdad into ghettos, the same way the Nazis did in Warsaw, Poland. And what they're saying is, with our unity, we destroy all the walls of the occupation. So go ahead and good luck. We're not the first to invade Iraq, coveting its resources. We're probably not the last, but we're going to end up kicked out like everybody else. And here they're demonstrating against the wall. Now, I can't tell you who's Sunni and who's Shia and who's Kurd in this picture, and it certainly doesn't matter much to them. This is Iraq winning the Asia Cup, such a huge victory for themselves and for the country to give hope to the people. Again, you can look online. You can find out who's Sunni and Shia and Kurd, but it doesn't matter to them. This is a Western division and a Western construct. And these were Baghdadis sitting in a cafe witnessing the winning goal. And the government issued a curfew saying, if you go out, there will be violence in the streets. Don't go out. And Iraqis were like, do you know when was the last time we had something to celebrate? We're going in the streets. And even in Karbala, they were celebrating this victory with a lot of pride to out of the dreariness of their lives. So when they talk to you about sectarian strife, just remember there's a very proud people living there who will fight us to the, well, us Americans, to the death for their dignity and their sovereignty. That's never going to die. You can't quench that out. So what do we do? Here's your take-home list. Bring them home now. And you guys got to do some work on Afghanistan. Ban depleted uranium, ban cluster bombs, ban landmines, ban war. In the back of my mind, it's not a concrete project yet, but with my medical background, I would like to go back and help start reconstructing the hospitals that have been destroyed in my name as a step towards apology and healing. Whatever you do, obviously I'm very passionate about what I do, and because it's very personal, but I don't care what's important to you. Just stand up and speak out, because if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? And it's very important that you don't give up. Iraqis are not giving up. Most Americans are not giving up, those who are not profiting. I know Canadians are persisting for justice. I can see that by the turnout tonight. Together we all persist for justice. And don't you dare give up until your mission is accomplished. Thank you all so much for your attention. It's been wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much.
Today we heard an eloquent speech by Dalia Wasfi on the human costs of the war and occupation of Iraq. To see her photo essays, as well as supporting documents for her talk, listeners can go to her website at www.liberatethis.com. You can download a copy of today's show on www.echoshock.net/brownbagger. للموج ينادينا إن خفق النوم بأعيننا والورد أحمر للريح تحاسبنا إن أخطأنا للرمل الأصفر للموج ينادينا إن خفق النوم بأعيننا والورد أحمر يا دمع الناس فإن كنت عذابا يوميا لا تحضر يا دمه يا دمه يا دمه يا دمه يا